This is session 9 of the PDH online audio course on electrical specifications. This is the appendix on Detroit Public Schools, beginning with specification 16150. The reason this is included in the appendix is to demonstrate a specification. Examples are a very good way to communicate, and also because it's an interesting concept. It's just starting to grow that commissioning is being recognized as an important part of the construction process. Is this 16150? Well, the people in Detroit chose this number, and this is where they put it. Other people might put it in different places, and I think the new 26,000, the new Division 26 electrical specs have a place already set aside for acceptance testing. But it's interesting to see how this is done, and I'd like to share it with you, pointing out that this is a work in progress. The version we're reading was issued in February of 2004, probably created a little bit before that, and we can be sure that it's been revised in the standard form and for specific projects since. Part 1, General. Related documents, drawings and general provisions of the contract, including general and supplementary conditions, and Division 1 specifications apply. All work performed under this section is subject to all the requirements contained in Division 16000. Description. Provide basic materials for electrical work and install in accordance with contract documents. I'm trying to think what that has to do with electrical acceptance tests. Description is provide and install the equipment. But again, well, let's continue and see. Contents. Major items of work and equipment included under this section of the specifications are materials and finish application for a complete installation. Described herein are the following. Definition of tests, final acceptance, test reports, environmental requirements, protection of personnel, scheduling of tests, general testing requirements, test on wire and cable in 120-208 volt lighting and systems and power, test on wire and cable in 277-480 volt lighting and power, tests on grounding, tests on special systems. Now that certainly sounds like a good idea. And again, we're communicating clearly with everyone on the project. We're telling them what we're going to test, and we're promising to tell them how to do the tests. Let's see if we deliver on that. Definition of tests. Preliminary inspections and tests. Visual inspections of electrical equipment, wire checks of factory wiring, and any other preliminary work required to prevent delays during performance of the electrical tests. That is scary wording. Typically, our goal in specifications is to give measurable demands so that it's easy to identify whether the contract performed the requirement or did not perform the requirement. When you see any other preliminary work required, it becomes unmeasurable because who determines whether it's required or not? That's an undefined section. This thing about factory wiring checks, I've never seen an electrician take a cover plate off a machine and check wires in it. That's not what they do. They find the input and the output connections, and they put field wiring on them. So this is going to be a difficult section to enforce. I know exactly why it's here. If they have trouble at startup, they can blame the contractor for not doing something nobody expected to do him anyway. All we're doing is shifting the blame. We're not really trying to avoid problems. And perhaps that's a useful activity. Lord knows lawyers make a lot of money. Electrical acceptance test. Those inspections and tests required to show that workmanship methods, inspections, and materials used in erection and installation of the electrical equipment conforms to accepted engineering practices, IEEE standards, the National Electric Code, and manufacturer's instructions. Again, I think this paragraph deserves work. We're looking for something measurable. What are the tests we're performing? IEEE standards? Do you have any idea how many IEEE standards? I mean, back in 1986 when I knew things, 141 was the red book that told you how to do system wiring. There's 141 specifications in 1986. Don't you think they're probably up to 1,000 by now? This doesn't tell the contractor what to do. Now, the newer wording on this, and I'm not saying that Detroit has adopted this newer wording, but when I see other specifications with the same intent, they reference NECA, and I think it's NECA 1, the first specification issued by the National Electrical Contractors Association, and it tells you what to test. Perform all the tests identified in NECA 1 would be a measurable specification. And NECA 1 is like $10 or $20. It's not an expensive book. More a pamphlet. But again, it's very descriptive and very communicative. It tells people what's going on. What do you do when you perform the test? It's kind of scary to tell people to perform tests. Well, I performed the test. Failed every one, but I performed the test. Bad. That's not our objective. Our objective is to have a good installation. Notify engineer of any discrepancies. You know, I mean, that's kind of boilerplate and vague, but at least it gives them an action item, and we can find out, did they perform the test? Did they notify somebody if there was a problem? Let me share with you one of my problems. As the world goes the direction of having a construction manager, I got a good feeling about this. The construction managers I work with are very competent people, and it's a special advantage that all of their experience is in dealing with contractors and getting stuff built on time within budget. I mean, it's a very valuable contribution they make. But who do you report the test results to? Normally, the way this works is the construction manager identifies the deliverable when he reads through the spec, and he makes a list and kind of identifies on his big old bar chart. You know, that's what construction managers do, huge bar chart. He identifies on his bar chart where the inspection's supposed to take place and where the report's supposed to be delivered. He may even have a gadget set up in his computer so it reminds him to check on it when that date hits. Have they performed the test? Where are the reports from it? When you say report to the engineer, so often the engineer is not on the project any longer after it's been moved into construction. Design engineering is a design function. It's not a construction service. And the owners have a choice of buying construction services from whoever they choose. I personally endorse the concept of construction manager. I've seen it work so well so many times. I can't say I've ever seen a failure of it. Now, obviously, you know, with the range of people we have, there's going to be some poor people around. But I think they get weeded out pretty quickly in that area. Again, returning to the Detroit specification. Operating tests. Tests performed on all equipment installed under other sections of this specification to show that the electrical equipment will perform the functions for which it was designed. Now, does that say that the electrician is supposed to test out the air conditioning terminal unit? Boy, that's certainly what it says. I don't like that at all. If the thing's going to fail, I'd rather have an HVAC technician turn it on when the smoke comes out of it. So again, this requires a little bit of attention. If we want those tests, let's make sure we're absolutely happy with the wording here, and again, that we've got some follow-up, and what do we do with the reports? I mean, there's nothing wrong in my mind marking with an indelible marker on the side, checked electrical and the date, and perhaps the fellow's initials in legible form. Boy, how they like to put a smear up there and say, oh, I signed it. Final acceptance. Final acceptance of electrical equipment will not only depend on the equipment integrity as determined by electrical acceptance test, but also depend on complete operational tests. That's probably a good idea, and it implies that there is an operational test in the equipment specifications, and that's an important concept to take along. This is one of the things that is growing, a trend to put in the equipment specifications what the acceptance test is, what the operational test, and make sure that the contractor reserves some man hours to show the owner how the equipment works. Test reports. Submit test reports including complete data on actual readings taken and each corrected value to the owner's representative for approval after each test period. Perhaps I'm picky, but what's a test period? I think maybe the author's intent here was after each test session, because that sounds right. submit two copies of final approved test reports to owner within 3 days of completion of the work under this section and specifications. The report must be legibly signed and dated. Usually, the contractor does not deal with the owner. The whole concept of construction today is that the owner has a central competency. If they're an industrial plant, they make widgets. If they're a school, they teach kids. If they're a museum, they mark the aisles so people can walk through them and they keep people from touching stuff. You know, there's a reason the owner is the owner. The owner hires people to design and build his structure, and he probably doesn't want these coming across his desk. He probably doesn't know what to do with them. So, I know exactly what's going on here. In the Detroit Public Schools, the owner is the public schools, and the public schools hires a construction manager who they call DPS-PMT, I recall. And when they say report to the owner, they mean to the PMT, project management team. Environmental requirements, humidity, do not perform mega or high potential tests during times of relatively high humidity. Okay, let's look at this closely. The statement is wonderful. You don't want to do mega tests under high humidity. You get huge leakage and bogus numbers. Also, some electrical equipment is hygroscopic that it'll absorb moisture into the insulation, and it's actually the insulation that is leaky that you're measuring. But when it's in operation, it's warm and it dries off the moisture, so it's not a valid measurement. However, whoever told them to do a mega test? See, the key is if you want them to do a mega test on wiring, you tell them which wiring and when to do it. And it's desirable to put a little information into how you want them to do it. I made a mistake some time ago on a project that we're going to reuse some existing cables. And I said, let's mega the cables, make sure they're acceptable. And I got back numbers that looked real strange. So I called up and got in contact with the foreman who did the testing. They did not take them off the circuit breaker when they megered them. Well, that means we were getting all the leakage of the switch gear in addition to the leakage of the cable. Well, all I wanted was the cable. That's what it said. I mean, megger the cable. His interpretation of megger the cable was clip a test lead onto the lug and crank the megger. Well, that's not what it means. When you megger a cable, you take both ends off. And when I did it, we put them in a jar. And I'm trying to remember why we put them in a glass jar. And I think it was so it didn't fall in a mud puddle or something. But in any event, we would megger from the conductor to ground. And I wasn't happy with what I got for that. And what did I learn from it? That if you're going to tell people to megger and you care how they're going to megger, you got to tell them how to do the meggering. By the way, I think megger is still the registered trademark of somebody who's been sold again and again. So it's a new people that I probably don't remember, but Megger is a brand name for a high resistance tester. And back in the old days when it was Biddle, they were mighty fine equipment. I have no reason to think they're any less now. I'm just not familiar with them now. And this ends environmental requirements. Somehow it seems to me there ought to be something different, additional in here. Maybe at least ask them what the temperature was when you did it. Protection of personnel. During cable tests, station a man at each point where the cable has exposed connections. Ah, so their actual intent was to leave it connected to the switchgear when you megger it. I'm not sure that's good test procedure. I've got some people I know who all day, every day do testing, and I will check with them to see what they think about that. It's kind of interesting when you talk to these people on the phone, there are different levels of competence in the organization. And I think this is the way it's always been. It's just always a little bit of a surprise to me anyway. At the bottom, you got the guy who clips the clips and cranks the cranks. And he knows what he's supposed to do, and he does it, and he moves on to the next one. Above him, you've got a fellow who's got a little broader view, idea of what we're looking for, can tell whether the numbers are good or not. If they're bad, he tries to get it fixed before they're submitted so that we don't get the complaints going up and down the chain. And then above him, you've got a guy that used to do it 10 years ago and has learned an awful lot about it and sometimes shares my despair with the way the world's changing. Scheduling of tests. Schedule a sequence of tests so that equipment can be energized immediately after completion of applicable test and approval of test reports. Notify the owner's representatives of time of tests at least 48 hours prior to testing. Now, as a design engineer, I like to be out there for the testing because, first off, I learn a lot from these guys. My job is sitting at a desk, maybe typing at a keyboard, marking red pencil on a piece of paper. I don't get to see the field and the problems they run into. And it's very valuable for me and for the next project to ask the workman, where'd you have trouble on this? What could we have done better? You know, just like running a survey at the end of the project. I much prefer talking to the field workmen than the supervisors. The supervisors just kind of bang a fist on the table and say, it's your job to figure it out. Well, the guy in the field's the guy that has to figure it out, and he's the guy I'd like to find out where his pain occurred and maybe how we can avoid it in the future. And usually he's got a pretty good idea. If you'd been just a little smarter, Mr. Design Engineer, you would have done it this way. And those are valuable contributions. There should be a little more communication, I believe, between construction and design. General testing requirements: perform preliminary inspections and tests prior to performing acceptance tests. Test. I think it would be good to have a sequence here. Perform preliminary inspections at some particular time in the project. Test immediately prior to performing acceptance tests. Acceptance test usually means witness test, where you would have the construction manager watch, and if you're nice, offer the design engineer come in and watch too. High potential test. Do not perform more than one high potential test on any conductor unless specifically authorized by the owner. But see, they never told him to perform high potential tests. So this is a little scary also. I don't know if you're familiar with these different cable tests. On a Megger test, you run it a little bit above its operating voltage, and I think it's a factory test voltage. You measure how much current flows. And so it's meg ohms of resistance for very, very small currents. And the instrument you use is incapable of providing large currents. You can't get any kind of short circuit or fire or destructive result from a Megger test. A high pot test, high potential test, uses a different instrument, and you watch as the current charges the equipment. Typically on high voltages, there is a capacitance component on the cable, and it will actually charge as a capacitor, and you can tell lots of good things. I'm not the smartest guy on high potential tests, but there's a lot of information available from high potential tests. But it's a potentially destructive test. It's above the operating voltage. It's way above the operating voltage. And as I recall, in the cable manufacturer's instructions, they tell you how many high pot tests the cable will survive before the test induces failure in it. Now we're going into Megger tests. Megger readings are specified, as specified, are the minimum readings desired in an ambient of 60°F at a low relative humidity. See what I said? They're picky about the temperature and they don't ask you about the temperature. I would say that's an error. If you're interested in the temperature, you find out what the temperature is. Why are we telling the contractor that it's bogus if it's not at 60 or if it's not at a low relative humidity? Well, I would say this is a faulty paragraph. It's a good introductory paragraph. Let's see what the next one says. Maybe they've answered my question. When Megger readings fall below the specified minimum, devise some means of applying heat for the purpose of drying the equipment, subject to the approval of owner's representative. Oh, let me tell you what happened there, because that sounds mighty strange, but it isn't. There's been a change of context with nobody telling you. Meggers are performed on just about anything electrical. We were talking about testing the cable. We were talking about testing switchgear. Both are very valid Megger tests. You want to do both of those tests. We also do Meggers on equipment like large motors, 500 horsepower motor. On a 500 horsepower motor, very sensitive to temperature. Well, how do you raise the temperature of a 500 horsepower motor? I mean, this is the thing the size of a small shed made out of steel and copper. Okay, what you do is you run a small current, 120 volt current through it. and typically it'll have no effect on anything except slowly raise the temperature. So it is possible to raise the temperature if you're doing this construction in December or January in the north and you're getting bad readings because of the low temperature. On the other hand, what do you do if you have a high temperature? Well, in the device called the Megger, there are correction tables. If you're running at 90 degrees F, what that's equal to at 60 degrees F. And again, that's typically for cable. When I did a lot of industrial work, we Meggered equipment. Now that I'm doing commercial work, we Megger cables. But Meggering is certainly a good idea. Continuity tests. Perform continuity tests with a DC-type device using a bell or buzzer. Do not use phones for continuity tests. Use phones only for communication. I think the spec writer is telling you a horror story that happened many years previously, and I think it's probably a bad idea. Bells or buzzers draw amps at DC, and I don't think if there's any data cabling nearby, you don't want a 6-volt battery and a bell. I mean, it's just a bad idea. On the other hand, you don't want a high impedance device. A high impedance device is like a good Fluke electronic meter. And I'm saying that wrong because Fluke has some meters that are especially intended to push enough current through a circuit to get a valid measurement of it. So Fluke wasn't the correct answer on that. There are some cheap import meters that have like 50 megohms input, and you're almost measuring RF on the line rather than resistance. We won't talk about meters, but I have strong feelings on that, and let me share it with you. If people are risking their lives, it is an important instrument. It's not a good place to save $10 or $20 or even $50. Test wire and cable in 120-volt distribution. Give each 208 120-volt power feeder and subfeeder a continuity test and a Megger test. Okay. Verify phase identification for each power feeder and subfeeder cable. Verify identification of 120-volt circuits on panel directories. Make operational checks on 120-volt circuits to prove the circuits perform all functions for which they are designed. That doesn't tell you what tests to do. And there's a gadget, I think Ideal is the manufacturer. It's called a circuit analyzer. It costs about $100, but it gives you an expanded row of lights telling you how it works, and it includes return impedance. You can get into a lot of trouble on receptacle circuits if there's a loose wire nut on the neutral, and it just doesn't show up except things don't work. Computers trip off and things like that. And this $100 Ideal gadget tests for that. They've also got a super humdinger. Oh, that tests for arc fault circuit interrupters. I haven't gotten into that, and we're not talking about bedrooms in Detroit public schools. Forgive me, that was inappropriate. Check all power feeder and subfeeder cable connections for workmanship and conformance with standard practice by visual inspection. Again, if I were writing this, I would say turn in a report identifying which cables tested. And that if you think this through, this doesn't have to be burdensome. I checked all the cables in panel 1B. That answers the question. But you indicate to the workman what you expect back from him. He doesn't have to list the labels on all the cables, unless that's what you want. And again, communicate to him what it is you want. Megger test, minimum acceptable reading for disconnected cables, 100 megohms. For connected cables, no minimum required. Okay, we're going to run these tests, and we don't care what the results are. Think that through and make sure you're real happy with that. Records include the following information in test reports on each 120-208 power cable. Complete cable identification and description of isolation means. This is the report you're supposed to turn in. Okay, they did think this through. Megger readings included converted values. That's the temperature compensation we were talking about. Approximate average cable temperature. I would have asked for the ambient temperature because I don't know what the cable's doing. But I got a pretty good idea, what the wind on the back of my neck is doing. Test on wire and cable 480-277. This looks like somebody had a word processor and copied it word for word from the 120-208. Ah, here's something new. In the records, complete cable identification and description of isolation means. Okay, they're saying if you open a knife switch that you're not getting leakage through the equipment. That may be correct. And that's the only change from the 120-208. Tests on grounding. Inspect ground conductors and connections for conformance with the design specifications and for satisfactory workmanship. Test resistance to earth of each ground rod and each ground grid. Test ground paths for equipment and structural steel grounding. Now, that sounds vague when you say satisfactory workmanship, but honestly, people in the electrical trade have a very developed eye for this. You can see something that was done right. You can see something that was done sloppy. A careful electrician leaves a lot of marks of the care he puts onto the job. And again, all you have to do is look at a few, and the one that doesn't have it stands out like a sore thumb. Test ground paths for equipment and structural steel grounding. How do you do that? Do they mean use an ohm meter? Do they mean use a low resistance megger? There's a special device you can get that does milliohms and microohms. It's not clear to me. Test resistance of each ground rod. Okay, there's two ways to do that. There's the old method with the ground megger and remote earth, and there's the newer method with the clamp on high frequency device. And I think you want to tell them what you're looking for in the result here. If either of them is satisfactory, then say either of these is satisfactory. But let's not have an electrician figuring out something with an ohm meter to tell you about the ground. That's probably not a good idea. Also, I'm worried here if this is the place to mention it, but the problem with ground connections on structural steel and equipment is that you tend to get some corrosion or even paint on the lugs. Now, I'm not saying this right. You got a piece of steel and you bolt a lug onto it. Well, what you're supposed to do is wire brush the steel before you put the lug on it so you get a good metal-to-metal contact. I don't think there's any way at all to put that in this test report to find out if that was done. But that is something we certainly do want done as part of creating the ground connections. Maintain each ground rod isolated from the associated ground grid for tests on individual rods for resistance to earth. Not resistance to earth, resistance to distant earth. The words are important here, and it's got to do with the way the test is performed and the validity of the results. Include associated ground rods and interconnected wiring tests in each grid system for resistance to earth. Okay, so there, and again, my point is, turn in a report that says each ground rod, and how are you going to identify the ground rods? Turn in a report on each ground system, and how are you going to identify that ground system? Include ground bus on equipment, grid connection, and associated intermediate copper ground conductors in tests on ground paths for electrical equipment. So that says there's supposed to be a ground test on electrical equipment, but I never saw it anywhere. See, this is hidden at the end of the specification, where to hook it up, and we never told them at the beginning they were going to have to test it. So a contractor could easily say, well, it wasn't in the scope of work at the beginning. The fact you're telling me where to clip it on doesn't tell me to do it. And, of course, the construction manager, whoever, will come back and say, well, it's in the specification. You have to do the things in the specification. And what would actually happen in the real world is it would be a trading point. There would be something that the designer forgot that's going to cost the contractor money, and you trade that to the contractor for something the contractor was supposed to do but didn't do or doesn't want to do. And again, that's the way the games play. That's how we do the project on budget, within schedule. Include structural steel connections, grid connections, intermediate conductor in tests on ground systems. Maximum acceptance resistance to earth is 5 ohms. And as I mentioned earlier, 5 ohms is impossible to reach in some parts of the country. So isn't that interesting? I think somebody's going to fake results on the report. Tests on each ground grid. Test each isolated ground grid as specified for individual ground rods, except maximum acceptable resistance to earth is 5 ohms. In tests on isolated ground systems, the maximum acceptable resistance to earth is 2 ohms. I don't think you're ever in this world going to see 2 ohms. Maybe if you soak it real good. Tests on ground paths. Test ground paths of electrical equipment and structural steel for continuity by applying low voltage DC capable of furnishing up to 100 amperes. Tests on ground paths. My gosh. Ground path for electrical equipment or structural steel must conduct 100 amperes. Resistance as calculated from the current and voltage must not exceed 0.01 ohms. I don't know how to perform that test. I mean, we're telling the contractor to do this, and I don't know what it is we're telling him to do. I know I've got a battery. I've got a big automotive battery. Maybe a truck starting battery. For electrical equipment or structural steel. You got these two clips, see? I'm going to hook one onto the ground frame, you know, the ground dead frame of a piece of electrical equipment. Maybe they mean the other clip goes on to a steel column someplace nearby. And watch 100 amps flow. Most interesting. Wonder if they've ever gotten a report on that. Love to watch a contractor do that. Ooh, can you imagine the sparks when you clip that clippy on? Acceptance. Grounding materials and connections must pass all inspections and meet all specified maximum and minimum values. Okay, there is a hesitation here. If the contractor is inspecting the contractor's work, there's a possibility for collusion here. That's why, again, in the newer specifications, very often they're hiring a third-party inspection firm who is supposed to have no contractual relationship with the no fiduciary relationship with the contractor, so that we get totally independent inspections and test values. I have a good relationship. I like to think I have a good relationship with contractors, and I trust them, and I watch them to see that it's justified. But again and again, I see contractors doing good things. You ask them to do something impossible or something very, very difficult and out of their business, and they'll resist and sometimes just avoid doing it entirely. But I've never seen them go to a lot of trouble to lie to you. Records. Make complete records of all tests. Include resistance values obtained, calculations, methods of test and calculations, more calculations. Reports must be legibly signed and dated. Indicate the test instrument used. Tests on special systems. Perform operating tests on all special systems to prove that all design functions are satisfactorily performed. Unfortunately, that paragraph says nothing. I mean, what tests on what systems? It's not a specification if it says perform all tests on all systems. I mean, there's no measurability to determine whether it was done and turned in on time. If you want the clock system tested, you got to tell me what kind of test you want to perform on the clock system. If you want the PA system tested, you got to tell me what test you want performed on the PA system. If, let's see, what would other special systems be? I worked one place where they had lights. This was just marvelous. They had a light inside that the teacher switched on at the door. I think there were two switches. One was everything was okay, and the other was they're having trouble and need help. Oh, and by the way, the switches and lights didn't work. It was an older school we were renovating. I said, what are these switches? What are those lights? Well, they used to have it, if they had trouble in the classroom, they'd switch on the red light and the assistant principal would stop in. That would be a special system. How would we test that? Pretty easy, see if it works. And I think the light bulbs would burn out in short order. Okay, that ends section 16150. And again, I want to emphasize, I'm not criticizing the people who wrote this specification. I think it's a good idea and it's a good implementation. It's a first step, and it's at least 2 years old. So they've improved it since then. And if you use something like it, these are things you might look for to improve also. Now, when they gave me this specification to put into the construction package, they gave me another one. Let me share that one with you also. This is Detroit Public Schools Specification 16010. Notice again, they picked an unused number out of the CSI set, and they said, it's going to be my number, and I'm going to use it for electrical commissioning. Before we were talking about electrical tests, this is electrical commissioning, and this is much shorter. The electrical systems and devices listed below shall be commissioned, and the contractor shall follow and conduct all items necessary to complete the commissioning process as specified in this section and Division 1, Section 01810. Contractor shall identify and provide services of an individual to participate in and be responsible for implementing and reporting the commissioning program. The proposed individual will be intimately familiar with electrical installations and system operation. The commissioning authority and project management team reserve the right to interview the candidate or request additional information prior to placement in the position. The following systems and devices shall be commissioned: sleeves and fire stopping. Now, I'm going to spend a little time on these, and I apologize for digressing, but it might be interesting to you also, because how do you test a sleeve and fire stopping? Well, I watched a guy do this. I mean, for a week, he tested the sleeves and fire stopping on a medium-sized project. How did he do it? He went around and looked under the panels. Usually, you've got an awful lot of core drilling around electrical panels. And if they hadn't put in the sleeves or fire stopping, he says, here's a list to play. Oh, actually, what he did was he had colored paint. Each time he took a different colored paint so he could tell if it hadn't been fixed on Monday, hadn't been fixed on Tuesday, hadn't been fixed on Wednesday. And each day he gave him a list of what was remaining. So the first list was pretty hard to do, and then he deleted the ones they did as they did them. Why do we do this? Because fire stopping saves lives. Why do we do sleeving? Sleeving saves conduits. Again, I'm not sure your familiarity with this, but all conduits rot away as the years go by. I do water plants. Water plants have very high humidity, and that's the reason I say they rot away. So they came up with this idea, let's use aluminum conduit, which doesn't rot away. Well, it doesn't rot away in the air. It rots away every time it touches a piece of concrete. So what you've got to do is wrap it with something when you stick it through a hole and grout it, or put a sleeve of something that it is compatible with and is also compatible with concrete, like a PVC sleeve would be keen. You know, it totally inert, causes no problem. But then you've got to put a layer of grout on the thing, non-shrink grout, so that it's fire stopped. Or we were real on the last project where I was watching this guy do this. There's a 3M product that is a super good fire stop that everybody liked. Now, when would you use grout and when would you use the 3M product? I don't know. I should probably check into that. Next time we do this course, I'll have a little more information for you. Grounding and bonding. You look in the back of the panel, see if it was done. Identification. Again, before they put the cover on the panel, see if the wires are labeled. See if the panel directory is completed. Conductors and cables. How do you commission conductors and cables? I think there's an implication there to run the Megger test. Raceways and boxes. Just shake them, see if they rattle. If they rattle, the lock nuts aren't tight. Look for bushings. I really like bushings when conduit and cable enter a box, especially if there's a tight bend when it first enters. Bushing is very important there. Receptacles and switches. The National Electric Code requires you cannot have a space greater than an eighth of an inch around an electrical box for a switch or receptacle. And people don't do that. They figure that's somebody else's job. It's not the electrician's job. And if you wait till the end of the project, they've got to go around and repaint them after you fill in those little holes because the stuff didn't fit. By the way, I've got a special solution for that problem, too. Put an oversized cover plate on and nobody can see the hole. And I guess the hole disappears. Electrical controls. That should show up in the equipment being controlled. I don't think we test electrical controls independent of the equipment. Transient voltage suppression. How do you commission that? Well, on transient voltage surge suppressors, it's very important that you have a small ground lead, like they say 6 inches maximum. So what you want to do is pick off the incoming voltage and then run straight to ground. And you don't want it off to the side of the box. The integral surge suppressors are better than the external boxes that you nipple into it. If you're going to nipple into it, do it at the top where it's close to the incoming. And again, the number I've seen in the manufacturer's instructions are 6-inch maximum lead length, because you want to get those surges before they go into the panel and go into the equipment. So the more impedance you put between the source and the sink being the surge suppressor, the more you're going to miss going somewhere else. Lighting and lighting controls. That is something you notice when you flip the switch, lights don't go on. I don't think that takes a lot of close special attention. Switch gear, switches and circuit breakers, enclosed controllers, panel boards. Let me say something about enclosed controllers. Careful designers think through what they want on their motor starters. Do they want a handoff auto switch? Do they want a panel indicator? Do they want an incandescent panel indicator? Do they want an LED panel indicator? And if you've got a good design engineer, somebody should go to some trouble to make sure that the stuff installed matches the specification. The specification may be in the words in the specification. It may be in the pictures of the drawings. Transformers. Again, this comes back to that bonding thing. Make sure that the X0 goes to ground if it's an appropriate place for the X0 to go to ground. Fuses. Yes, we should at least have the right fuses when we start the project. They may not be a year down the road, or certainly not 20 years down the road. But they should be right when we start the project. Fire alarm. The new, the supplier of the fire alarm does the startup on the fire alarm, and there are detailed specifications in the fire alarm section on how to do this. But just walking by, you want to make sure the trouble light isn't on. Security TV. Security motion detectors and door switches. And again, they're saying walk around and test each one. Make sure it does the proper alarm when the system is armed. Educational TV. Don't wait till the teacher and the kids are using it to find out it doesn't work. Data distribution system. Somebody else does that. The electrical designer usually does not. If we're going to do it under the electrical contract, we better make provision for it. PA system, and I've seen specifications, and it wasn't in a separate commissioning spec, but it was in the sound system spec, saying you're supposed to go around there with a sound meter, and they had a maximum and a minimum in the room. When you're standing under the thing, it should not be painful to the kids, and there's a number for painful. I think it's something like 75 dB. It might be a little more reasonable than that. They should be able to hear it. Well, to be able to hear it means something like 10 dB above ambient. You don't know what the ambient is, but say something like 25 dB. Everybody should be able to hear 25 dB, don't you think, in a reasonably controlled classroom if no one's throwing anything. Contractor shall submit, conduct, participate in, support, and document all relevant commissioning tests and testing tasks, including but not limited to manufacturer's factory testing certificates, pre-installation checklists, pre-start checklists, manufacturer's check, test, and start, system startup and testing, functional testing including numeric values of volts, amps, foot candles, sound pressure levels, noise levels in dB, and bit error rates, identify instruments used for all tests, training, operation and maintenance manuals, commissioning meetings, scheduling of commissioning events, review the plans and specifications with respect to their completeness in all areas relating to the commissioning program. This includes ensuring that there are adequate items included in the design to ensure the ability of properly test and adjust the systems and to document the performance of each system. Assist in the development of the systems testing documentation forms for all equipment tests. That's what I was wondering. Where do these forms come from? Apparently the contractor, at the beginning we said we're going to have a full-time person who is dedicated to this, making up the forms and performing the tests to make sure they're done. The contractor shall furnish commissioning agent copies of the field quality control test reports, for example, tests specified under 16080. Contractor shall document all testing as part of the commissioning process. And that completes this section. Section 10 next will be Cleveland Water Department Checklist for Operation and Maintenance Manuals. I hope you'll join me.